So what I want to do is start at the beginning and basically build the earth for you, because clearly there's a potential for building heterogeneity in from the very beginning. There are plenty of ways of making heterogeneity after we assemble the earth, and there are plenty of ways of destroying it. And that's kind of the theme of the whole workshop, is how do you make them, how do you break them. So we'll start with the solar system, then we'll talk about the early Earth, we'll talk about what we know of the age of the Earth, talk about what the oldest rocks look like, then we'll digress a little into a thing I call spidergrams, which Don showed you yesterday, and you'll see lots of these, where somebody gives you a whole list of elements, and here they give you a concentration normalized to something else, and you get some funny line, okay? I call that a spidergram. And the reason we use that is basically geochemists now have almost a whole periodic table to play with. So again, on Don's comparison of geochemistry and geophysics or seismology, and I don't even remember what the axes were, but we're quite a way away, and this axis, as I remember, was number of parameters we have to play with, and geochemists are almost inundated with parameters. We'd probably be better off if we could get rid of some of them. The problem is every time we begin to understand the ones we have, somebody adds a couple more, which is confusing not only to the geochemist, but I'm sure immensely confusing to the geophysicist. Okay. And then we're going to, so after we talk about spidergrams, I want to just talk a little about isotope systematics. I mean, clearly the isotopes have an enormous bearing on the question of mantle heterogeneity. And there are a whole bunch of isotopes, and again, every time anybody begins to get a handle on the ones that are on the table, some geochemist comes along and says, oh, have you heard about osmium? That tells you that you're wrong. So, I'll try to give you a general way of thinking about isotopes, which is then applicable to any isotope system. So you can sort of think of it in a general sense and translate it to any system that somebody throws at you. So the solar system started some time ago. We'll talk about when. Nucleosynthesis was occurring. We made all of the periodic table in the early sun. This was dispersed through the solar system, and things started to cool off and condense. So you basically, the whole process of early accretion was taking little particles and sticking them together and making bigger particles. And the early parts of that are a little obscure, but there have been fairly good models for once things sort of get fist size, how they interact and accrete, and how you build giant things out of these little chunks. We have many of these little fist-sized pieces sitting around still. They come into the Earth as meteorites. They've been stored in orbit in the solar system since day one. And they provide us with really the best evidence we have for composition of unfractionated material. Now you'll see that while we have a lot of information about meteorites, we actually don't know a lot about the Earth. And the problem is the Earth got put together, and then it got fractionated into all these layers, and we have direct access to only the surface parts, a few hundred kilometers. We have remote sensing capability for much of the rest of it, but the issue of what is the bulk Earth composition, for example, is incredibly complex. I'll give you my impression of what we know about the bulk Earth. Geochemists, the holy grail would be if somebody ground up the whole Earth, okay, and gave us this little sample of powder that was representative of the whole Earth. And this would be, well, if we had that, we wouldn't be here probably, because we wouldn't need to be. Okay, so I need to tell you a little about, just a little about meteorites. And there are a whole bunch of classes of meteorites. The ones that are most interesting are called chondrites. And they are called chondrites because they have these little chondrules of sort of primitive material in a matrix, and they're all stuck together. And there are various classes of these: carbonaceous, and then a whole bunch of names: C1s, CMs, C0s, CVs. And you don't really need to know anything about that. Usually C means carbonaceous, okay? And they're called carbonaceous because they have a lot of carbon in them. C1s have been for a long time the Rosetta Stone, because they have the most volatile, the highest volatile content of water, CO2, carbon, sulfur, chlorine, and so forth. So they are the least kind of manipulated, and perhaps the closest thing we have to primitive material. They also have abundances of the whole periodic table, except for hydrogen and helium, that are very, very close to solar abundances. So we would hope that the sun is sort of representative of the average solar system composition. So for a long time, people just said, well, we don't really know what the composition of the Earth is. We'll assume it's like these guys, give or take some of the volatiles. Okay. So then we have another class called ordinary. I'm not sure why they call it ordinary. There's nothing very ordinary about it. And they divide these into a bunch of alphabets as well, okay? And then there's a third class called enstatite chondrites. They're interesting basically because they're very high in orthopyroxene, and there are arguments against this being a bulk Earth composition, and that this is closer to a bulk Earth composition. This is not a volatile rich class, and because it's largely enstatite, it has a lot of silica, and you'll see how this plays into our uncertainty about the composition of the lower mantle in particular. So, and then there are achondrites, which, as you can guess from the name, means they don't have chondrules, and they've generally been processed. So they've gone through a melting episode sometime early in solar history. And then, of course, the irons, which we won't talk about very much, but these are metallic nickel iron bodies, which we presume are cores of busted up planets, and that perhaps the Earth's core, if you could solidify it, would look like some one of these, and there are a whole bunch of classes of these guys as well. Now, in the process of making the Earth, the early solar system was, during this accretion process, was an incredibly violent time, because you have very large protoplanets which would bump into each other, and there'd be massive collisions and breaking up, throwing them into different orbits. And so the whole process was one of taking large bodies, bouncing them off each other, trading places, putting them into new orbits, and so forth. So the moon, for example, the best model now for the moon is that it was ejected from the Earth by one of these giant collisions. And we'll see again, we have samples of the moon, so we can tell something about the age of the moon. Now, one of the, these of course chemically have many, many differences. they have some similarities, and Don alluded to the fact that the most refractory elements, and we'll talk a little more about that, but the elements that condense at the highest temperatures in the solar nebula have relative abundances to each other that are very similar in all of these classes of meteorites. So for example, calcium and aluminum, or samarium, neodymium, are virtually constants through this whole thing. So in a sense, we don't have to decide which of these the Earth is like, as long as we think the Earth is like something here, and we can determine some set of relative abundances of these so-called refractory elements. Yes.
Yeah. Real quick question. Do you have any idea of what proportion of chondrites versus achondrites might form here, or are the achondrites older than the younger?
We'll actually talk about that a little bit. So there are achondrites that are, in fact, older than the Earth. But it's a little complicated because, we'll talk. What is the age of the Earth? You know, what do you define in a body that's accreting as the age? I mean, it's starting, you put two pieces together. Is that the age of inception? Do you wait till it's full size? Do you wait till the core is separated and so forth? Anyway, we'll talk about that.
One thing that's worth pointing out is that
what was the question? Sorry.
Mass.
Chondrites tend to be small. Iron meteorites tend to be large because they don't break up when they enter the atmosphere. So the mass of chondrites, all the chondrites that have ever been found and collected, is probably still way less than the mass of the irons because they come in meter-sized things. And while there are fewer of them, but I don't think any of that's really relevant. I don't even think the abundance of so-called falls, the things that we actually see falling, necessarily tell us anything about their abundance in space, in the solar system, because there are some things that come in time after time after time that may be just part of a single train that you're just sampling over and over again, and there may be other orbits full of meteorites that are in fact never injected.
So how many chondrites or C1 chondrites or S-type chondrites have we actually analyzed and that's used as, you know, primitive earth or primitive metal or whatever, bulk silicate earth? How many of those are actually, how many statistics do we have to actually make those?
No, it's tough. I mean, these guys, because they're volatile rich, are very fragile, and most of them don't survive their trip in. And they're perhaps, I'm guessing, but of order 20. And there are a few classic ones that have been studied a lot because they're fairly large. Ordinary chondrites are by far and away the bulk of all the incoming meteorites. So we've got tons of those. Enstatite is a relatively small class of those. They're finding new ones all the time, and so they're in fact adding new classes. These letters are typically added when typically meteorites are named after where they hit, you know, the local town or something. And so if you have one that hits in Allende, you give it an A, and then you may give a new class if it's a sole composition. So, a lot of work goes into has been until people sort of gave up the whole idea of finding the chondrite class that was like the Earth. I mean, this has been 30-year study hoping to do that. But one of the ways of doing it is based on oxygen isotopes, so need to just... Oxygen has three isotopes, 16, 17, and 18. And you can measure the abundance of these, the relative ratios of these, and they're fractionated because they're light and they're fairly large difference in mass. You know, this is 2 out of 17 is a pretty significant mass difference. So they fractionate by equilibrium, they fractionate kinetically, they fractionate in many ways. And on Earth, if you look at all materials, they fall on a line with a slope of a half, because this fractionates twice as much as this because it's twice the mass difference. So you'll have all terrestrial materials define this line, called the terrestrial fractionation line. They can do the same thing with all the meteorites. And I wanted to, maybe I can do this without rotating this plot. Okay, on here, let's put in okay, Mars. You say, wow, how did we measure oxygen isotopes on Mars? They haven't even sent the mass spec there yet. Turns out they're the class of meteorites, which are in fact achondritic meteorites, that are believed to have come from Mars. Now that's an incredible stretch. Think, wow, something hit Mars, blew off a bunch of material, and some of it ended up on the Earth. But there have been pretty good estimates of the composition of rare gases in the atmosphere of Mars and things that make it look like this story is pretty good. Okay. So anyway, if you measure those, yeah.
I should say there was a report, I think, this last week that surface analysis of some of the rocks on Mars actually had a volcanic.
Okay, well that's good. I mean, the meteorite community has no doubt that this is true. I just find it almost, you know, it boggles my mind. But okay, so you do oxygen isotopes, and they don't fall on this terrestrial fractionation line. So the message is, oh, they came from some kind of a different collection of stuff than the Earth did. What we can do, we can add everything on there. C1s, ordinary chondrites. And none of that. Carbonaceous chondrites in general. Is there a strange thing that in the carbonaceous chondrite clan, there are very high temperature condensates embodied in or trapped in some of the carbonaceous chondrites. And they have an oxygen 16 anomaly. They have pure oxygen 16 added from the very earliest part of nucleosynthesis that doesn't show up in the rest of the solar system, but it basically pulls things down in that direction. Okay, so those don't look right. C1s, in fact, don't look right. I mean, if you use the strict argument that the Earth must have the same oxygen as whatever meteorite class you think it came from. So these don't work, these don't work, Mars doesn't work. The only class that actually fits on the Earth line are the instatite chondrites. So there is this was an argument made by Marc Chavois in Paris, and nobody believes it for a variety of reasons, but it's really hard to say, well, how can we, you know, it's the only meteorite class we have that actually fits on the terrestrial fractionation line. So how can we exclude it? I don't have an answer for you. I mean, it's a fairly vigorous debate between Mark and everybody else. And Mark is well capable of holding his own, so, yeah.
Do the insect chondrites match the earth and other isotopes or composition?
Well, we have to sort of get into that whole story, and we'll do that.
Why don't we
I don't know. Just, I don't know why. I mean, it would disrupt our whole model for the composition of the earth, because they're so rich in silica. Then to put the earth together and make stuff like we see at the surface, the peridotites from the upper mantle are not like that at all. And so you'd have to do some really fancy chemical processing. But I'm not sure that's not true. No, absolutely. I mean, that's basically where the bottom line from where we are now, where I am, is actually the Earth doesn't look like any meteorite class. Why should we think it did or would? Because every part of the solar system is stratified, you know, compositionally. Why doesn't the Earth look like Neptune? Well, because it doesn't. Okay. So I think, you know, it's a good idea to free ourselves, perhaps, of looking for this silver bullet of the meteorite that we can analyze and tell us everything about the Earth, and instead concentrate on these things that are constant throughout the classes of chondrites. And those we can, I think, reasonably say should look like the Earth, or vice versa. Follow up this a little bit. Don talked about volatility and the fact that the Earth may look like chondrites in general in terms of refractory elements, but it certainly doesn't look like them in volatile elements. And the way the meteorite guys usually look at this is they have a thing they call 50% condensation temperature. And I don't know, we go from maybe 600 to 1800 Kelvin. And I can challenge you all to keep track of what I say in terms of there being circularities that are beginning to come into this. And if you can identify the circularities, you know, feel free to challenge, because there are indeed circularities. So we're going to take the Earth composition. Well, where did we get that? We'll talk about that in a minute. But you divide the Earth by carbonaceous chondrites, C1s. And so a ratio of 1, well, let's change that a little bit, because we're going to talk about, no, that's fine, so 1. Looks like that, okay. It's a little above 1 because we know if you take carbonaceous chondrites and get rid of the volatiles, there's almost 30% volatiles. We know the Earth doesn't have that much volatile, so that increases the concentration of everything else. But relative to each other, they're all the same. And there are things like tungsten, rhenium, platinum, calcium, aluminum, okay. All the things that you may not think of as refractory, but the meteorite guys, these are things they just identify as refractory. And then we go on down this decrease of volatile elements. And I'll just put a few in here that will turn out to be important. Lead, arsenic, chromium. Usually you'd think of chromium as refractory, but in fact it's not. germanium, sulfur, lead. Okay. And the reason I'm showing you this, somewhere, let's put rubidium in here as well. That's because I probably didn't mean to call it lead. That was the one I was looking for. I wondered where rubidium was. Okay, thank you. We get two leads.
I usually think of phases as the relevant being either volatile or...
Absolutely.
Is there an assumption about, for example, oxidation stage? Are they all assumed to be tied up with oxygen?
No. No, it depends on, clearly depends on oxygen fugacity. It depends on what phases are actually, you know, what the mix is. You can't take an element in isolation and really say this. This is just their shorthand, and it's done in a rigorous way, but it's not necessarily relevant to what's actually going on. I think I actually don't know the answer to this, but I think it's strictly take the element and look at its boiling point.
But for example, lead, one of them is lead, completely different from lead.
Yep, I couldn't agree more.
So the way they've done this is start with gas of solar composition, and then condense it and calculate what phases come out. First phases that come out are things like aluminum oxide, calcium aluminum oxide, then magnesium aluminum oxide. And one of the interesting things is the reason that those complex are instant types and not organic pyroxene is because there's no iron. And some of these phases that come out at high temperature are pure magnesium phase. It's another interesting thing. Iron doesn't start getting involved in the lower temperatures.
So for solar composition,
composition
presumably has enough oxygen to tie it
all up. Is that true? Most of the iron in some of the iron that's in chondrite is the iron in chondrite is more oxidized than the iron in the earth.
No, I think you're right though. Fundamentally there's enough oxygen in the solar composition to tie stuff up as oxides.
And so
I mean, what you're saying is strictly true, but I don't think it's crucial for sort of ordering the elements. I mean, I think everybody would agree these guys up here are refractory, and these are not, and that these are deficient in the earth, and we can talk about why we think these are not. What I really want to show out of this, though, is we're going to talk about isotope systems. Okay. And the systems are things like uranium lead, samarium neodymium, lutetium hafnium, rubidium strontium. And it's helpful to identify where the parents and daughters lie on this sort of general volatility index. Okay, samarium neodymium, these are up in here, so they're on the flat part of the curve, so we expect the earth to be like chondrites in that. Uranium lead, well, uranium's up here with the refractory elements and lead's way over here, so here's our parent and here's our daughter. So in the process of making the earth, we either left lead somewhere else, in other words, it didn't condense, or we put it, the other argument is we put it in the core because it's a siderophile element. In any event, the part of the earth we look at is grossly depleted in lead, so the chondrite model is totally hopeless in guiding us as to what the uranium lead ratio of the bulk earth would be. I'll show you in a minute that we actually have an extremely good constraint on what the bulk earth is for reasons of isotopic systematics, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
The other side of the story, though, is because there's so much separation between uranium and lead, that system dates the Earth.
One
processes in the early solar system, whereas uranium, you think, is another half.
Right. Lutetium, hafnium, both refractory, they're both up here, so they haven't, we can use chondrites as a guide to that. Rubidium, strontium, well, here's rubidium. Strontium's up here. So it's the same problem. The Earth is deficient strongly in rubidium. If you measure strontium isotopes in chondrites, they're way higher than almost everything on Earth. And it's because the chondrites have their full budget of rubidium. So again, you know, chondrites are useless for establishing bulk Earth, quote unquote, rubidium strontium. Lars?
I'm still puzzled also by the refractory versus volatile argument. And it seems to be important. So it's compounds, not elements, that are refractory or volatile. And the Grossman-Larimer sequence is well defined, but it produces lots of really oddball compounds that aren't very meteorites or the Earth.
Yeah.
And so the relative refractory or volatile nature of these different elements might be different in the actual phases that exist on Earth versus the oddball ones that come out of the condensation system.
I think that's right, and I still really want to only say that there are refractories and there are volatiles. I don't think, well, I don't even know this, but I don't think you could manipulate a way to fractionate these refractory elements. No, I won't even say that. Meteorites, for example. If you take a meteorite, it's made up out of minerals. And the lutetium-hafnium ratio in those minerals varies from mineral to mineral. So you certainly fractionated lutetium-hafnium when you assembled the meteorite. There's a big problem right now with trying to establish the bulk Earth lutetium-hafnium based on chondrites, because these hafnium in particular is associated with minor minerals, and the size of meteorites that most people get to analyze is so small that they're actually not representative of any significant size body. So every time you look at a meteorite, measure lutetium hafnium, you get a different answer. And it's, you know, at the 5% level, which is kind of messy. So when I say we know bulk Earth lutetium hafnium, I'm actually lying. It's a big fight right now, but yeah. So, okay, so what I jumped over a little bit is this, and that's first little circularity. I'm going to tell you that we use chondrites to derive this, and yet now we're taking what we used and derived and divided it by what we just used to make this argument. Okay, so let me tell you a little about how we actually attempt to use chondrites to determine something about the Earth composition. Okay. Now, it's really difficult because, as I said, we only have samples on Earth from the upper few hundred kilometers of the Earth. And we can measure a lot of that stuff. Okay, we've done that. But then we have to make a statement about whether that's representative of some larger part of the Earth. And as somebody alluded to, as Bruce alluded to earlier, there is a contingent, and they're well-reasoned, that says, really, there's not much going back and forth. Now, seismologists tell us stuff goes down, all right? And I think that's pretty unequivocal, and most everybody except Don Anderson believes that. But it may not be really a massive exchange. Okay, there are complex rare gas models that have argued for less than 5% mass exchange between the upper and lower mantles. And these are models that are really difficult to refute, and I don't know what the problem is, okay? I can't demonstrate that that's wrong, and yet the evidence for subducting slabs through 670, I think, is overwhelming. But the point is, if this is to some extent true, we're sampling this box and calling it bulk earth. If we've had minor mass exchange, it's possible the chemistry down here is in fact totally different. And for a long time, there was an argument that the chemistry here was silica rich. And I'll show you why we have a silica problem in a minute. And that's why Marc Chevalier, based on the oxygen, but also based on this sort of missing silica problem, said, well, the silica's in the lower mantle, and we just haven't seen it because we haven't seen it. Okay. So how do we approach this problem of bulk earth? Well, there are a number of ways. You've heard this thing called pyrolite. And this was generated, this whole idea, by Ted Ringwood many, many years ago. And he basically said, well, I think the mantle is perditite. Okay, assumption number one. Big, big assumption. And he said, but most of it's lost a melted component. In other words, most perditite that we see at the surface has been decompressed and partially melted, and the melt has been extracted. So he said, so the perditites we're looking at are residual from melt. He said, we know that we can get melt out of the mantle, therefore the perditite that must be down there must have a melt component. So he just took these depleted perditites and added basalt back in them. He said, I know it had to be there, so I'm just going to put some back. Well, okay, how much do you put back? Okay, well, again, Ted said, well, you know, we think the extent of melting typically is 10 to 20%. Or put another way, we think the peridotite that is in the mantle should be able to produce 10 or 20% basalt. So I'll put back 10 or 20%. Okay, and that gave us pyrolite. It's actually incredibly close to what we think the upper mantle composition is. So, I mean, Ringwood was a genius at getting the right answer for sort of all the wrong reasons. Okay, well, we can do a little better than that, okay? This was a great idea. You recognize this is a fictitious rock, okay? It's not a real rock. So, a lot of people like to use the word pyrolite, and they like to use that as the model for the mantle, but I think, you know, we can do better with real rocks. So we're going to take and plot magnesium silica against aluminum silica. I won't even put the units on because these are in metal ratios, not oxide ratios, and it doesn't really matter. Okay. What we're searching for is primitive mantle. Okay. What we get when we look at peridotites, and again, the focus, you'll notice, is on peridotites. Well, we could focus on something else and say, I really think the mantle is something else and not peridotite. So built into our thinking is this enormous prejudice that the basic mantle material is peridotite. Of course, you know, we've done years and years and years of seismology doing P-wave, S-wave velocities, at pressure and temperature, and do they look like what you get when you take a peridotite and measure the velocity in the lab? And the argument goes back and forth, and it's usually permissive, but I'm not sure it's exclusionary. Anyway, if we look at peridotites, because we think that's what the mantle is, we get this basically field that looks like that. And the concept is that this is basically a melt depletion array. Okay, that somewhere down here you had the original mantle, and as you melt it, take the melt away, and then end up with this residual peridotite, which is what you pick up and analyze in the lab. So you get this array. So in principle, what Ringwood did was sort of smart. He said, well, this array is a residual melting array, so I'm just going to draw a line through it and say, basically, basalt would plot out here someplace. So you add basalt back here. Okay, but when do you stop? Well, Ringwood stopped at a point where he said, I need 20% basalt, so I'll put 20% back. So the real issue is, okay, is there any way we can decide where to stop? Well, then that's where you can bring meteorites in. And if you look at meteorites, these different classes of meteorites, and if I could see this, enstatites, ordinaries, there are other carbonaceous chondrites that you have to conveniently ignore because they don't fall on the straight line. Okay, so enstatite chondrites are depleted in aluminum, ordinary chondrites and C1s. And so I think Emil Jagutz in the late 70s was the first to take advantage of this alignment and draw that line. And he would admit that the Earth is not like any class of meteorites, but he thinks it's going to lie on the meteorite line. Okay, so we've given up the idea that it's a particular meteorite, but we've stuck to the idea that it will somehow be related to the other meteorites by this line. And then, lo and behold, there's your bulk Earth.
When would the meteorites fall on the line?
Nobody knows. It's a very good question. I mean, I won't even speculate. So this gives you the stopping point. And it's not far off from where Ted Ringwood sort of thought there should be 10 or 20% basalt. Okay? But you'll notice it's based on this assumption to start with. Based on the assumption that the Earth in some way is related to meteorites, even vaguely, okay, and that gives us the composition of the Earth.
Yeah, I suppose that the C1 and all the rest, somehow we're getting more and more evolved in that direction. And now we've gone off the other end, and now we're getting that was less evolved than the other end.
Right. You would say that. Well, you know, and we've also ignored this little group of other chondrites, of which some of them are the highest temperature condensates, the earliest condensates, and so forth. Okay. If you look at this composition and try to make it out of, let's say, a C1, you clearly have a problem with silica. Okay, so you can either say that the Earth actually isn't like any meteorites, but it's part of the meteorite, the chondrite clan, or you can say that this array, strictly speaking, represents the upper mantle, which is where all our samples came from. Okay, so really all we can say legitimately is that this might tell us what the upper mantle composition is. We still have this problem. Okay. And so there was an effort to say, well, if the upper mantle looks like this, maybe the Earth can still be C1 chondrites, but and the difference between here and here is stuff that's not in the upper mantle. So you've got a missing silica problem. Ringwood circumvented that very neatly by saying, well, we know the core of the Earth is, its density is lower by 5 or 6% than pure iron. So you throw some nickel in, and that doesn't help. So there's got to be a light element, so-called. And the choices for light elements in the core range enormously. Oxygen, sulfur, maybe carbon. And Ringwood, noting that silica seemed to be deficient in the upper mantle, decided to put it in the core. And you can do that. I mean, I don't know that the high pressure experiments would allow that, but people seemed okay with that. So you put enough silica in the core, you can still make a C1 Earth, and the difference is all what you put in the core. You can still make the lower mantle the same as the upper mantle, and that's fine. Just the difference between this and this. Okay. You've removed, if you want to start with a total Earth, they're both, taking silica out of something will move you up this line approximately. In other words, this is a silica array just because it's in both denominators. That makes sense? If you take this point and do nothing but take out silica, you change both of these ratios by the same percentage. Yeah. Pardon?
Why would you want to
start? Well, you look at all a bunch of plots like this, and you pick the plot where these guys line up the best and these guys line up.
That's what I mean. If you normalize both sides, you get nice lines because of
and calcium. Okay, so I think that's really what we know about the bulk Earth. I mean, that's pretty pathetic, in my opinion. But if you do this trick, okay, take C1s. Okay, to make the Earth out of C1s, what do you have to do? You have to take them, you get rid of the volatiles, 30%. So you increase all the residual concentrations by 30%. Then you take the iron and nickel out, enough of it, to make the core. That raises everything some more, okay? And then you take out this silica problem, that raises it a little more. And then, in fact, the concentration is about 2.5 times C1s. So then if you believe all that, all right, that's like six steps you have to believe. Makes it really easy. We just take C1, the table of concentrations for C1s, for the refractory elements now. Multiply it by 2.5 and you've got the bulk Earth concentration of these refractory elements. And almost all the published papers now will use this. There's a paper by McDonough and Son in 1995 that sort of tidied all this up. And that's what we all use. And I think it's okay, but it's based on a lot of jumps. And I think the biggest jump is this one here. If we've never seen the lower mantle, how can we even pretend to know what it is? And what will it do to this plot? One of the arguments, which I think is pretty reasonable, is that You could make a plot like this involving samarium and neodymium, for example. And when you do that, the intersection will happen at samarium neodymium equals the chondrite. So there's really good argument that the upper mantle, peridotite in the upper mantle, in its pre-melted state, has a samarium neodymium ratio that is, in fact, like chondrites. Well, all chondrites have the same ratio, so that's sort of helpful. Then the argument is, in the early Earth, if you're going to make the chemistry here different than the chemistry here, how would you do that? Okay. You have to do some chemistry. You have to fractionate some elements, either by mineral phase separation. You know, you can't easily make two layers of the Earth in silicates that are different without involving sort of mineral fractionations. These inevitably involve chemical fractionations. And then the argument is, well, to make major elements different in these two layers by any significant amount, you would almost have certainly screwed that up. Okay, that's another little jump of faith. But I think to first order, it's pretty hard to imagine a process that would make a major change in bulk major element chemistry between the upper and lower mantles and preserve that. What we know about the partitioning, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, partitioning of these two elements between phases like perovskite and melt, olivine and melt, spinel and melt, is that they are pretty strongly fractionated. So it would be a coincidence if you did a major element fractionation and left those two guys the same. I mean, you make the same argument for lutetium, hafnium, and so forth. So there's, I don't think that's totally compelling, but that's the argument people will make for why we can now take peridotite from the upper mantle and apply that to the whole silicate Earth. Okay. So if you're hoping for a really, really neat, tidy answer where, you know, somebody analyzed one little vial of powder and gave you this composition, that's the problem. Okay, let's switch gears a little and talk about the ages of things, the early condensates in the solar system. Yep.
So one place, just tied in some of the other things, one place with this number 2.5, or whatever one you decide to put in to come into play, is that's the number that you will multiply the uranium and thorium concentrations by also to determine what the heat production is.
Absolutely.
And then this other diagram of the depletion with the versus the condensation temperature, that's good. Where you put potassium on there will give you the other part of it. So,
yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, thorium, uranium, and potassium are the major heat producers in the Earth, and our estimates for that are totally linked to this whole argument. I mean, I'm happy to have something really simple-minded like this, I can tell you, but it may be wrong.
Properties versus the size of carbon step, but the uncertainties don't allow us to distinguish those two yet. The uncertainties in the experimental constraints on what the physical properties are at the relative condition.
And that's been true for like 20 years.
Well, I mean, yeah, we have uncertainties, but I was showing that there, at least with the experiment results that the measurements that I've made, that your prototype pyrolite pool of lower mantle is systematically different from the prem, less dense. And so even with our uncertainties, it's still systematically
Less dense.
But
so putting more perovskite in would go in the right direction then?
Putting, if you increase the, if you just leave a silicate, a perovskite mantle,
Well, I mean, I've watched this argument for 20 years waiting for the silver bullet. And so whenever anybody tells me that, I don't mean to disbelieve you or anything, but I've been here so many times. Somebody will say, no, we've ruled out a peridotite lower mantle, absolutely dead. And then, you know, 6 months later, somebody will say, oh, but...
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Clearly,
sometimes
you've got
iron,
yeah. No, you've got to do a real composition, whatever,
so
for sure.
So you need to worry about aluminum and calcium. Yeah. I mean, even that, you know, even when I only look at you know, just kind of those that suite of elements: magnesium, iron, silicon, aluminum, calcium. That's the major elements, and I don't think that there's too much controversy over that. But who knows? Maybe even some neighbor, even more minor
complements
like sodium, perhaps.
Yeah, or water.
Certainly water.
That's right. You can always throw water in when you want to confuse somebody. Let's talk a little about ages, okay? Partly because it gives us, you know, the starting condition, but partly also, and I'll show you after lunch, that the lead isotope system is extremely powerful in, if we knew the age of the Earth, whatever that means, and I'll tell you the options, it's extremely good at telling us what primitive Earth should look like. Okay. So, I mean, one of the obvious arguments is, are there any materials on Earth that haven't been processed since the beginning? Is there such a thing as primitive mantle? You know, 20 years ago, it was the rage to make the upper mantle depleted and the lower mantle primitive. Well, I'll show you that I don't think we have any unequivocal examples of primitive mantle. I mean, if we did, then we could just analyze that and this whole problem would go away, clearly. So there's been a large cottage industry looking for primitive mantle and using different criteria to identify it. But we'll talk about it. So, ages. And these are, there are billions of ages in a few times. Okay, I'm just giving you a flavor. I seem to be able to keep this in place. Allende is a chondrite with these so-called calcium aluminum-rich inclusions, meaning the highest temperature condensates were trapped by later condensates and not homogenized. And so when we look at ages, and we'll talk later on about this age actually works, okay? But what it's called is a lead-lead age. And it's the most precise way of dating things for a variety of reasons. One is there are two uranium parents, And you have to know the half-life of the parent, okay, to get a precise age. And because uranium has been of mild interest in the past 50 years, the half-lives of those two guys are really, really well known. Okay. So, this is millions of years. Now, you all know the Earth is 4,500 million years old, right? 4.5 billion, we've known that since 1952. And it turns out, I mean, just as a side anecdote, Claire Patterson did the first quote-unquote age of the Earth by taking primordial lead from an iron meteorite and average ocean sediment, which he thought was going to average the Earth. And he drew a line between these two and calculated the age, and he got 4.52 or something. Well, then later on, the people interested in uranium changed the half-lives. So his age became wrong, but at the same time we realized that sediments are not really an average of the Earth in any way whatsoever. And if you used a better idea for what today's lead should look like, you came back, it exactly balanced out the change in the half-lives. So he was so lucky. Anyway. I don't know whether you find that stunning, but I think that is stunning. Okay? I mean, typically, geochronologists, if they can measure an age to a few percent, think they're just absolutely golden.
So that this date really refers to these calcium. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. I couldn't actually tell you. I mean, this is obviously an it has to be an isochron. I'll check into that. I don't know whether it's different minerals relative to the calcium aluminum inclusions or what, but I guess so. I shouldn't find it surprising. It's precise if I don't actually know what it's based on. Again, I don't know, but the beauty of this system is all you have to do is measure the lead isotope ratio. You don't have to measure anything else. And these days you can measure isotope ratios just unbelievably well. So let's put down a few others. So these are within error basically the same, okay? And, you know, 10 years ago anybody would have been happy to think that that was the right age, and it's good. So achondrites, I guess one of the eucrites, that's another subclass of achondrites. Now, the other kinds of ages, if you want to just compare them, a Sumerian neodymium age on these same eucrites again, within experimental error, but with a much larger error. Now, this may seem to be a little overkill in terms of, well, really how well do we need to know the age of the Earth? But in fact, the starting point, because of the precision of this lead-lead technique, the starting point in age sets today's lead composition for bulk Earth almost precisely, if we know the starting point. We know something about the age of the Earth. Okay, so when Patterson started all of this, of course he used a chondrite to establish the primordial lead, So his age of the earth really wasn't an age of the earth because he was using a chondrite. But the general conception all along has been the age of chondrites will be the age of the earth, again, because we think the earth was related. If we look at lunar anorthosites, again, lead age. I mean, this chronology is beginning to help us understand how fast things were put together. Achondrites have been through a melting process. Typically, some of them are basaltic, but there have been a molten body at some point. And yet we see they're only 5 or 10 million years younger than the oldest body that we have. So we are able to put things together as solids and then rapidly heat them enough to melt them, all in a period of 5 or 10 million years. So that's very helpful for the chronology. And following on that, the lunar anorthosites, if the moon was really formed by a giant collision with the earth, okay, then the earth has to be older than the moon. Okay, so the moon is 4510, the oldest rocks that have been recovered. All right, so you have to remember that. It's possible there are older rocks, but these are already pretty old. They're only 50 million years younger than the oldest things in the solar system. So it appears that we put the earth together, blew off the moon, all within 50 million years of the beginning of the oldest condensates. So the whole time scale for the early solar system was incredibly fast. Now there's another thing that we need to know before we can use any of this really to, again, talk about the age of the earth. Well, we say it should be between 4510 and 4567, but there's a new isotope system for anybody that's figured out the old ones. And again, a very powerful system. If we go for another 10 minutes, is that okay? And then we'll just talk about this one thing. Yeah.
Are they samples that
were
collected from moon outcrops, or were they just...
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, these were recovered by Apollo. Yeah. Yeah, doing real geology. There are actually also meteorites that people think have come from the moon, just as we have a class that kind of are believed to come from Mars. So, again, I find it unbelievable that as rare as meteorites are, you could make meteorites on another planet and have them end up here. But anyway. So we're going to talk a little about extinct radioactivities. We'll talk about one particular one now. We'll talk about a few more later on. This one that I'm going to talk about is particularly helpful in dating the time of core formation. But at the same time, because of the way this works, it basically builds in or gives you evidence for a heterogeneity in the Earth that we could use to identify primitive materials. And you'll see how that works. This decay system hafnium 182 decays to tungsten 182 with a 9 million year half-life. In nucleosynthesis, okay, you were making this stuff continuously during nucleosynthesis. Once you isolate this, put it in a box, and stop making it, it dies with a 9 million year half-life. If you, whatever you do, then say 3 or 4 half-lives beyond the end of nucleosynthesis is incapable of changing the 182 tungsten because the parent's dead. Okay, so the issue is, you can look at, and this makes, you know, makes a isotope ratio. I get the right reference isotope. And 4. This is just common tungsten, okay? It doesn't have a parent, it doesn't decay, it doesn't do anything. You made that also. But your reference, in, typically in all isotope systems, your reference a daughter to some stable common isotope. So we have the potential then of looking at this ratio in different solar materials, because it's a really, really good time scale for short-term events. And it's particularly useful on the Earth because this is a so-called lithophile element. Meaning it likes silicates, and the tungsten is a siderophile, meaning it likes metal. So when the core of the Earth formed, and this has been an argument for a long, long time, when did the Earth's core form relative to when you accreted the Earth? You know, did it sort of rain out, trickle out? I mean, it accreted with iron throughout the silicate, and then somehow you had iron metal, or you reduced and made iron metal and congregated it to the core. That gravitational energy is enormous. So you have a huge heat source associated with condensation of the core, accretion of the core. You'd like to know when that happened. Did it happen right away and then the Earth melted and cooled down? Did it sort of happen over time? This is an incredibly powerful tool because as you accrete the metal from the silicate mantle, it strips the tungsten out, leaves the hafnium behind. So if you did that process really early on, you would strip whatever radiogenic tungsten you had, you'd also strip the common tungsten. If it was a perfect thing, you could get rid of all the tungsten, there'd be no tungsten in the silicate. The parent would be sitting there trucking new tungsten into the silicate. So if you made that core formation really, really early on, I mean like immediately, you'd have a very high 182-184 tungsten ratio. You can look at this ratio in chondrites of various classes, iron meteorites and so forth, and basically establish a chronology for metal separation in those chondrite bodies. You can look at the moon, you can look at the Earth. And it turns out there are differences. Without going into the fine structure of the chondrites in terms of their sort of accretion age, but let's just maybe the best way to do this is to compare it. Okay, in any event, if there are ways to estimate the initial ratio that you started with, and then ways to, you can measure the difference and calculate based on the half-life how long this thing had been, how long since it was fractionated. Okay, so time elapsed since whatever, nucleosynthesis or the oldest meteorite age that we have. But let's take the oldest meteorite age, this 4.567 million years. This is not an absolute age, okay? It doesn't give you an absolute age because your relative age since you took things out of the nucleus synthetic factory. And so we pick this as the starting age, and then look at, let's say, core formation age. And we're going to go from 0 to 40 million years. And I thought there are a number of ways of doing this. But the latest paper plotted this, and this is now the hafnium tungsten core formation age, okay, just to be clear. And there, the Earth on here and the oldest thing would be that the chondrite that gives 4, 5, 6, 7. So, in terms of millions of years from the oldest body that we know about, the Earth is about 33, core formation on the Earth, okay, is something like 33 million years following that. And so the starting point we took is 4, 5, 6, 7. That's basically here. So that makes the Earth Mars, now you may say, well, what a funny plot. I mean, why should the core formation age have anything to do with the planet radius? I would never have thought to plot that. I guess the thinking is the bigger the body, the longer it takes to put it all together. Therefore, you can't really start to make a core until you get enough heat to make things move around. But in any event, it gives you the different ages. This is a meteorite. I'll tell you what the name of it is. But there's one particular meteorite, and this is almost like science fiction, that the meteorite guys claim has come from the asteroid Vesta. I think it's Vesta 4. One particular asteroid, pretty small, it's 150 kilometer radius or something. And okay, they've never been to Vesta, right? All they know about Vesta is spectroscopic composition data, which is, for a little body that far away is not very good. But anyway, these guys picked this one meteorite and said, I think that comes from Vesta. But it has the oldest hafnium tungsten age of any of the things that have been measured, aside from the oldest meteorite. Okay, so on Earth, put everything together. The moon, of course, doesn't fit on here because we don't know what the moon's original, how do you define the moon's radius? It would have carried, when it was blown off the Earth, would have carried whatever the Earth's tungsten was at that point. Okay, the Earth had been separating a core, and sometime in that history, you separated the moon. And the radius of the moon obviously doesn't mean anything because you didn't separate metal on the moon when it was its own sort of separate body.
Can we measure the hafnium age of iron meteorite?
Yep.
And
fossils.
Well, we don't have
data. Iron meteorites, they're in epsilon units, okay, which, don't worry about what epsilon units mean. They're -3 to -5. Okay, where the Earth is defined as 0 simply because you measure, take a bottle of tungsten, in the lab and measure it, and by definition you say that's zero. So the older things will be negative in epsilon. And in fact, iron meteorites, minus 3 to 5, H chondrites, minus 3, carbonaceous chondrites, minus 2, they're dead. But, okay, epsilon, one epsilon unit equals 1 part in 10 to the 4th. And to pretend that this measurement is easy would be an overstatement. In fact, 5 years ago, the people who started this business measured tungsten in the earth and in meteorites and in chondrites and claimed it was the same. And so that told you that the core formation was much, much later. It happened after all of the hafnium was dead. Well, so that was a really important thing. I mean, that was a major discovery. Well, then it turns out that it's technically really hard to do, and there were some problems, and now three labs have come along and said, no, actually, there's a 2 epsilon difference between chondrites and the Earth, and which helps us to actually put a limit on this, which means something. Now, the utility of this, okay, if we were to look at the core of the Earth, we could get a sample of the core of the Earth. The tungsten would be radically different, lower epsilon, than the silicate, okay? Because it's got all of this tungsten from the beginning and no hafnium, no parent. So it would be tungsten, isotope ratio, would be a marker for material from the core. Well, we're desperate to find some marker for material from the core. Last year, there was a report of tungsten and kimberlites that was different than tungsten in the surface. And that was unbelievably exciting because right away you go, oh wow, kimberlites come from the core. I mean, they don't come from the core, but they entrain stuff from the core. And if we had such a tool, I mean, it would just be unbelievably powerful. Unfortunately, because this is a really hard measurement, it turned out that wasn't right. So I'd be pretty skeptical about, you know, don't pick up a paper and read some claim based on tungsten unless you know it comes from one of the good labs. Okay, we're going to quit for lunch, I think. After lunch, we'll talk about old ages on Earth and some isotope systematics.